cover the two-meter band from 144 to 148 with a Mirage amplifier. I'm trying to think of the model number of that one. I'm looking at one right now. I can't read the model number of that thing. Mirage. Unfortunately, it's covered with, I got pieces of electronics in front of it, so I can't easily read the label. But the Mirage makes amplifiers of 100-150 watt capability, but one band at a time. To cover all the bands of a good signal generator and putting out 15 watts. Yes, you can buy things like that from Hewlett-Packard. They're a little bit pricey, I'll warn you. But one step at a time. Make the oscillator stages work first, make the other stages work. The value of a signal generator, let me drop this, is that you can turn the dial, get a predictable frequency, turn the other dial for the signal generator, for the signal attenuator, get a predictable amount of output power. So, the right power, the right frequency. Do consider the fact that modern-day signal generators don't do it that way anymore with variable inductors, coils, and capacitors in the oscillator. Almost everything is done these days with a phase-lock loop oscillator circuit. The advantage of the phase-lock loop is that it can, as long as it's got the right voltage-controlled oscillator as the final stage of the phase-lock loop, it can literally go DC to light, so to speak. And as long as you've got a high enough accuracy of the reference oscillator, which is usually a 10 megahertz crystal, the nice thing about the phase lock loop is that now you get an exact frequency. It literally counts every cycle, and so you can be accurate to the nearest 1 hertz at ridiculously high frequencies with the phase lock loop. By way of an inductor, capacitor, variable tuning network, but you'll never get anywhere near that accuracy. Let me drop it. And the next thing to consider is, do you really need that accuracy? If you also own a frequency counter, you can now have your cake and eat it too. If you get a hold of a really good signal generator, an oldie but a goodie, Hewlett-Packard 8640, I think is the model number. The 8640 has got a kind of a free-running oscillator. It's a cavity oscillator that's tunable with a slug that goes in and out with a worm drive. You don't know about that. When you're turning that dial on the front panel, that's what's happening. And it's got a beautiful frequency counter inside, so you know by way of the frequency counter, the light-emitting diodes across the front panel tell you exactly what frequency it's on, and it's got a mode of operation where you flip a switch, and it takes the frequency counter output, feeds it back, the frequency counter becomes a freak lock loop. In other words, if you turn it to 10.5043 megahertz on the frequency counter and you flip the switch, it'll hold that exact count from then on. So it becomes almost a phase lock loop. It's really a freak lock loop. So that particular signal generator, you have your cake and eat it too. A free running oscillator that goes to any frequency you want, as much accuracy as you want by way of the frequency counter, and by locking it with the frequency counter in the freak lock mode, it'll now hold that frequency even as it's warming up and cooling off, and you're changing the power output, and you're using it for the next 2 hours. Really beautiful, I mean. Feel the packet, let me drop it. They outdid themselves on that particular signal generator, 8640. In the native version, it starts off at 10 megs, it goes to 512. Almost everybody buys the frequency doubler for the final stage, so it goes to 1024 megs on the high end. In the low end, it's rated down to 10 megs, but you can make a minor modification. You can make it go down to 455 KC. It's an oldie but goodie. Troubleshooting it is a dream because of the way it's got the light-emitting diodes on every one of the printed circuit boards telling you whether or not the right voltage is present. I don't know the exact number, but in the old days, I'm guessing that signal generator sold for close to $10,000. Very high quality. It's got amplitude modulation, frequency modulation, all kinds of good stuff built into it. But on the surplus market these days, you can buy those signal generators for a couple of $100. So now, do you want to work on this slightly old-fashioned LC oscillator signal generator? Let me drop it. And do it as an investigation and a educational process. Go do it. If you want to take the same number of man-hours you're going to spend on that, and with your paper route, so to speak, you earn the dollars and you buy a used Hewlett-Packard 8640 signal generator, where you get all these extra qualities built in, so to speak. That's also a very high cost-effective way of doing things. So it's very similar to a guy who's into astronomy. You can grind your own mirror. It'll take you a year to do it, but you'll learn about mirror grinding and making things parabolic. Or if you want to look through a telescope, write a check and buy a telescope. Well, when it comes to a signal generator, there are really high-quality signal generators that, in the case of the 8640, I'm guessing that was a 1985 product of Hewlett-Packard. So, yeah, it's 30 years old, but that thing doesn't go out of date, in my opinion. By modern-day standards, it's bulky. I think it weighs 50 pounds, whereas a modern-day signal generator with a phase-lock loop system is only a couple of pounds and can run on a battery. This thing is a plug-in 110-volt power supply type thing. So as long as you're willing to use older pieces of equipment, you can get an awful lot for your money. And so now, which one do you want to do? And maybe you do both. But I'm offering all the choices in this particular case, trying to. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the tech net. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, that HP40, that was an excellent generator. I think it had a 13 dBm with the output of that thing. That's a good health generator. None of the old two generators had that kind of power output, especially those cheap ones. They were really low. So yeah, that's a project. It might be fun for him to try that. But if he wants to learn about the inductors and the capacitance and how that works as a tank circuit thing, that might be a fun project. But I think you're right. I think you should take his. You can get them from, just like you said, from $150 to $200 in fairly decent shape, and they are well worth it. A little clunky, take up a lot of room, but they're very good. Let me let it drop, and I get some good information for you. KC2, CMQ, found information on the Longhorn antenna. I think it's manufactured by K1KLO. So anybody who's interested, Hank, might want to look that up so you can get an image and see what Dick's talking about. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, somebody else wants to give us a couple of words. And it was a QST article in the beginning, but the QST archives does not allow me to find it. No matter how I spell Longhorn, Texas Longhorn, whatever, mobile antennas, I looked up zillions of articles on mobile antennas because I think this is something that's a possible candidate for Hank, but couldn't find it. And maybe K1KLO was the original guy who wrote the article. Maybe he opened up a business selling that antenna. Somebody else wanted to add some comments? Give me a call. That is the name right now. K2RIW in the tech net. Thank you for K2CMQ. I should remember his call letters. I mean his name. Let's go on to the next mailbag at submittal, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. That's it, Dick. Only one question this week of any importance or any relevance to what we're doing here. So we'll go on to the space report, and this way we'll have a long time. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
And you did say this call letter is a Kilo Charlie 2, Charlie Mike Quebec.
Yes, KC2CMQ. I'm pretty sure that was it.
Sure enough. Okay. Darwin in Bronx, New York. Nice website on QRZ.com. And I thank him for that information. Okay, Paul, what has National Aeronautics and Space Administration been doing? I think I did the calculation last week of, told me the exact number of astronomical units to my favorite spacecraft, Voyager, which turned out to be 12.18 billion miles, 131 astronomical units. That means the signal we send out there takes 18.15 hours one way. Round trip is 36.3 hours. Can you imagine sending a signal to a spacecraft, which is three times the distance of Pluto, and you just say, hello, Voyager, and if it answers you immediately, at the speed of light, the signal going out there and coming back takes 36.3 hours. Wow. That's really down the road a piece. N2XJ, here we go. WS2N, K2IW, you got a pull.
This is WS2N, yeah, 131.6. So yeah, you're right, 36 and change for the round trip. That's amazing. And yeah, Dick, plenty of information over the last year, but we're getting a little slow right now as far as launching go. The next Falcon 9 launch won't be until the probably the end of July. That's with the seventh cargo mission to the International Space Station, and they'll be bringing up a NASA International adapter to attach to the space station, to the TMA pressure mating adapter number two, and they'll have to do a spacewalk and attach that, and that won't be until the end of July, and that will enable future crewed spacecraft to dock with the space station. We don't have a shuttle up there anymore, and now they're going to use this new docking system. So that's pretty good. Let me drop it. So, and the other news is this Thursday, you have three more people coming back from the International Space Station. And one is an American, another one's a Russian. And then the woman from European Space Agency, for a while she was the only ham up there, Samantha Krista Peretti. And but now you have another ham up there, a Russian, and he's up there for a year. And I believe Kelly, Scott Kelly, the other one-year astronaut, I believe he's licensed. I'll have to look into that. So, but they'll be coming back. It only takes them like, 4 to 6 hours to return to Earth once they undock. So they stayed up an extra month because the Soyuz, that was the spacecraft at the end of April, they lost control and went into spinning. Last time they saw it, it had a camera on board. It was spinning 14 times per second, and eventually it deorbited. So they wanted to look into what the problem is with that before they bring them back. And they believe they have it tracked down to the something to do with the new upgraded Soyuz rocket system that's used to attach either the Progress or the Soyuz spacecraft to the final stage. So, hopefully they worked that out. They did ground all Soyuz launches until a couple of days ago. The Russians launched spacecraft into orbit using that same system. And it went okay because it's a different latching system than what they use on Progress and the crewed Soyuz on this unmanned reconnaissance satellite mission. Which, by the way, is probably going to be the final of sending a film. Russians still do this about once a year. They'll send a film for their reconnaissance. I guess they want to look down at our spaceports and and maybe Chinese space force. I don't know what they're doing, but every year they send up these spacecraft, and they still have film on board, and they send it up for 6 months or so and bring it back and develop it here on Earth. Even so, everybody's running digital and all kinds of electronic pictures for decades. They do the same thing, but they always run the run the same system that they've been doing for, I guess, since the 1960s. But from what I read, this is the final mission of that. They're going to give up on that finally. Like I said, not really much more happening. Like I mentioned last week, they have the approval for a mission to Europa. NASA does. So they're going to work on that probably for the year early 2020s, the early 2020s. They'll be sending Europa Clipper right now. That's what they call it. And they've got the approval for the 9 different instruments that they have on board for detecting this, what's below the ice on Europa. Europa is one of the moons around Jupiter. And they're very interested in that. There could be an ocean of water underneath, with more water under that ocean than we have on Earth. So they believe there's a chance, there's possible life underneath. There's heating that goes on from the tidal effect with Jupiter as Europa goes into somewhat of an elliptical orbit. And they want to see what's going on. So too bad it's not a manned mission. Just saw a good movie, Europa Report. Good movie. And where they sent 6 people on a trip to Europa. What was good about it is they asked NASA a lot of questions. NASA sent them a lot of pictures of what Europa looks like, all the science behind it. And if you read the reviews about that movie, they really do have everything right about it, about the science of going there and what would be involved, looking for life. And even Neil deGrasse Tyson did some kind of cameo. He played himself doing a report about Europa for, maybe a quick 20 seconds or so. And from what I understand, it was filmed in New York City somewhere, probably Brooklyn. And they must have a studio over there, and they gave credit to the AFL-CIO, heavily involved with putting the sets together for this movie. But in real life, they do got an approval to send an unmanned mission to Europa, and they plan on orbiting Jupiter, and not orbiting Europa, but just coming close to it, 40 different times during the primary mission. Maybe getting as close as they said, 16 miles above the surface. So that's the present plan. Too much energy would be required to slow it down to actually get it to orbit around Europa. There was a planned mission like that at one time, but it was a little too costly. So this is an abbreviated type of mission. Just like the, I've had questions of, why don't we put the New Horizons spacecraft into orbit around Pluto as it gets there, and that's coming up July 14th. And it would probably be about 1,000 times the more weight than they have now, would be needed for fuel to slow it down to put it into orbit, so you can't do that. So they're going to send it out on a path to the Kuiper Belt and investigate something out there. And by the way, I think I mentioned this last week. You can get a free app if you have, a tablet. And called Pluto Safari. 100% free. And it downloads the tablet, and it'll give you all the information, all the latest news about the New Horizon mission. It'll give you the first thing you see is a countdown, you know, how many days, how many hours, how many seconds before they get to the closest point of Pluto. And they give you all the news updates, pictures of what they've taken, and, you know, not animated, but actual pictures of the moon going around Jupiter, what they look like now. And they'll continue to send news reports as time goes on. And they also have a 3D model of, you know, where Pluto is at this time and where it was when the spacecraft left Earth. What a, you know, regular 3D model, you can move it around with your finger and all, and see what the story is. So that's pretty much it, Dick. I don't have anything else, but any questions from you or anybody else, I'll be here. K2RIW, this is WS2M. By the way, let me drop it. I could be reached at spacenetreport@gmail.com, but now you could also get me at my call letters, WS2N@ARRL.net. I put that on there as well. Back to you, Dick.
Pretty fine, Bill. I mean, Paul, glad that you're now emailable by way of the ARRL website. That's a very handy one where, as long as you know the guy's call letters, as long as you know he's an ARRL member, you can always get to him no matter how many times he changes his complicated web address, his email address. In the case of that movie, Europa Report, I don't know whether or not Europa, I think there's four so-called main Galileo moons of Jupiter, Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto. So Europa is the second one. I don't know whether or not it is tidal locked. In other words, is it really rotating? Is there a day and night, so to speak, or is it always aiming the same face toward Jupiter? Jupiter itself has a lot of strong, cosmic ray-like radiation nearby. I think whenever a spacecraft goes by Jupiter, it's got to be radiation hardened because there's a lot of stuff going on there. Let me drop it. So to send human beings in this movie, Europa Report, to the surface of Europa. And it reminds me of Star Trek, where you just beam down. You go to all these fancy places. On the surface, it sounds easy to put up with that radiation, to put up with the local temperature, to put up with the rate of rotation. Even if it is tidally locked and always aims the same face toward Jupiter, when it gets, Europa goes around once every 20 hours or something like that. So yes, as far as the sun is concerned, you're going to have if I was right in that guess, you're going to have a 20-hour day. But how hot and cold does it get during that day, and how much atmosphere does it have? Our nearest local body is the moon. And yes, we were there as of June or July 1969. Let me drop it. And Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon, he was there on Apollo 11. He is very disappointed that we, the United States, haven't gone back to the moon and established a station there. On the surface, that sounds nice and simple. He seems to be forgetting about the fact that NASA very carefully selected the exact spot on the moon that each one of those Apollo missions landed. You have to be midway between the early morning. You have to be either in the early morning or late afternoon, because at high noon, the surface of the moon goes to temperatures like 135 centigrade. That's 275 Fahrenheit. That's a little bit, not quite the temperature you cook a pizza at. And then at nighttime, it goes down to minus 165 centigrade. That's minus 265 Fahrenheit. So it gets cold at night, minus 265 Fahrenheit. It gets hot in the day, a plus of 275 Fahrenheit. Wow. You can't put a human being in there, no matter how well you insulate him. That's beyond the comfortable range in which you could run air conditioning, if you know what I mean, heating. So if they were in a capsule that's 100 meters below the surface where the temperature is kind of steady, great. But how do you establish that? You know, a real chicken and egg problem to set up that station below the surface. So to simply put, a colony on the moon rolls off the tongue very easily. You can't do that. So sending these human beings to Europa, I wonder if they got into any of these details, Paul. And where did you see that movie? Was it online or did you see it in the theater? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, it came out actually a couple of years ago, so I got it out of the library. They did have it. By the way, Dick, if you have an account for the library, Suffolk Library, they're going to do away with that in December. I'm not sure if you're still with them. I had an account, so I'm getting rid of the emails involved with that. But they're good for movies. You call them up, you say, hey, if you have your Europa report, and they let you know right away. So, library's good, it's free. But watch that, it's a good story. And they do talk quite a bit about the radiation and it's involved. They got involved with a spacewalk. They had to fix something outside. And what's involved with that? Things that could go wrong, do go wrong. You know, it is science fiction to some degree. The goal is to look for some kind of life on that moon. And I'm not going to tell you the ending because other people will listen. Dick, I know you don't care. But as far as getting everything right, I think it's pretty good. I don't know if any of the actors involved. I never saw it advertised on TV. So I don't think it's the world's most popular movie, but it's pretty good. Yeah, something else about something, but it went out of my head. Back to you, Dick.
You being interested in space as much as you are, for as many decades as you've been, Paul, I am curious, what is your favorite science fiction movie? You probably have a first, second, and third. Maybe it was Michael Rennie and Patricia Neal, The Day the Earth Stood Still. Or before that was Destination Moon and Rocket Ship XM, but these are real oldies. Nowadays, they're laughable because of the spacesuits they wore that were so primitive by modern standards. Or Forbidden Planet was another really well-liked science fiction. Everybody likes Star Wars. Name a couple of your favorite sci-fi movies, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, number one is 2001 Space Odyssey. In fact, I saw that probably a couple of weeks after it first came out. I think it was 1967, 68, something like that. And I saw it in a regular movie theater, of course, back then. And the older ones are very good. Naturally, I didn't see them in the movie theaters, the old black and white ones. I saw them as repeats when they came out on TV. Forbidden Planet, excellent movie. One day they had that on, Turner Classic Movie, so I just recorded it and wound up with a copy of that. So, they're classics. But top of the list is 2001 Space Odyssey. Back to you, Dick.
And how about the later 2010 and whatever? I think there's a trilogy of Space Odyssey movies. And I think even the later ones were done very well, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, they had 2010 Space Odyssey, very good. And I don't think there were any more after that. I know there's books. I've read read all the books, including 2061. I think the there's one after that that I probably didn't read. 2061 is very good. So, need to make a movie about that one. 2010 is good, but there's nothing like the original, of course. And when that movie came out, it was a screenplay, so it wasn't a book. So then the book came out, the book was like a guide to the movie. So you really can say the movie was better. Back to you there.
I wonder if 2061 was also done by Arthur C. Clarke. And is that the one where you've got this kind of space station-like thing, which is a ring around the Earth above the equator, and the spokes of the object come down to the Earth, and that's where you place the elevators. So it's a little bit like the space elevator. And the space elevator, it's an attractive-sounding project. We start digging into the details, it's very difficult. And it's got, unfortunately, a zillion failure modes. And when you do run into a failure mode, billions of dollars go down the drain that cost you to establish the space elevator the first time. So it was 2061, was it Arthur C. Clarke, and is that the one I'm thinking of, Paul? The Bruce 2N, KQRIW?
Yeah, that is Arthur C. Clarke, and I do have that book. So that's not a library book to me. I do have that one. And they have this permanent ring around the Earth, and all kinds of space elevators going up and down. And that's great. it's going to be a long time before that ever happens. But when I was watching 2001, back in the 60s, and, I used that as a prediction of what we would have by 2001. We were going to have this space station spinning around in space and colonies on the moon. We're way off from that. At least we got the space station. And it's been permanently occupied now since, 2000. So we're like 15 years of presence in space, manned operations. In orbit, at least we have that. But we didn't get quite as far as the predictions of Arthur C. Clarke. He's dead now. So I guess we're not going to have any more versions of Space Odyssey. This is WS2N.
In that 2061 Space Odyssey of Arthur C. Clarke, where you've got this ring around the Earth, it's a huge inhabited space station-like thing. I'm not so sure that's so easy to establish. If you think of what the moon does to the Earth by way of causing tides, and then literally the moon's gravity is making a bulge of water that you and I call high tide on the near side and a similar one on the far side because of the way it whips the Earth around. You think the moon is in orbit around the Earth. Actually, the moon and Earth are a binary planetary-like system where the mass center of that system is like 1,000 miles below the equator. So the Earth is wobbling about that point, 1,000 miles below the equator. And the radius of the Earth is roughly 4,000 miles. So there's another 3,000 miles between that point and the center of the Earth. And so this space station-like thing, this ring, we dropped. Because of the tidal forces caused by the moon. I'm not so sure that would stay together. That continuous flexing, I think, would break it apart. And establishing those elevators and those spokes, it makes good sci-fi, but if you actually look at the step-by-step procedure by which you do that, study the step-by-step procedure by which you create a space elevator, even if you had a material that's 60,000 miles long and strong enough that it could self-support itself. You have this big, heavy weight on the outside of it. On paper, it looks good until you start getting into the details. What happens if a hurricane goes through the area where the ground station is? What happens if an aircraft flies through that area? What about meteorites and lightning and so on? Mother Nature in this environment is pretty strong. I think you've seen that website I recommend people look at, which is extremely well done by Derek Mueller. Let me drop a If you Google the word Veritasium, V-E-R-I-T-A-S-I-U-M, I think it is, I-A-M-I-U-M, Veritasium plus radiation, and you look at that Derek Mueller 8-minute documentary where he visits all of the nuclear sites on planet Earth, Hiroshima and Chernobyl and so on, and goes there with a Geiger counter. And then he estimates how much radiation exposure the astronauts on the International Space Station are getting. And it's huge. I don't know the exact number, but I think it's the equivalent of a dental x-ray every day or two, something like that. Huge number. So that space is a pretty wicked environment. And those astronauts that go on the International Space Station are volunteering to have their body subjected to that, which could be life-threatening. And I don't know whether or not NASA has kept any records as to whether or not the rate at which the astronauts get cancer versus the rate at which the general population gets cancer. I wonder if they've documented that. I wonder if you've read anything along those lines, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I'm sure somebody's keeping record of it. You know, I mean, Sally Ride just died a few years ago and pancreatic cancer, but, you know, we got plenty of people dying of that same thing here. So, you know, you'd have to make a correlation of 30,000 astronauts, and we don't have that yet. We're up to a little over 500 people that have flown into space. So it's going to take a long time before you can make some kind of a chart. 30,000 people would be the number for, somewhat accurate predictions on how things are affecting people. So, by the way, last week I talked about the so-called flying saucer that it's supposed to be launched from Kauai in the islands of Hawaii. And that thing has not gotten off yet. It's been delayed, similar to last year. This is a similar type of test. And it's one of these, it looked like a flying saucer, but it's the low density supersonic decelerator that they're planning on eventually using to land heavy loads on Mars. That's been delayed. And if it goes another couple of few days, they're going to probably delay it until July. That's an interesting piece of equipment. It was successful last year, but one of the parachutes didn't work properly. The parachute itself didn't work properly. So they're going to make some kind of improvements. But they won't be able to use this for years. Next year, we have a Mars landing coming up called InSight. That will be launched next March to the planet Mars. And of course that's a regular 50-foot parachute, not one of these 100-foot parachutes that is flying for this. But they've used this before. In fact, it's going to be a very similar landing setup that they used for the Phoenix mission. You might remember that one. That was one that landed near the North Pole of Mars some years ago. It's going to have a similar layout. RTGs on board. And it'll probably last a lot longer than Phoenix, because Phoenix went up near, up in the north and wound up getting covered up with carbon dioxide, ice. They wanted to last, they wanted to go 3 months, and it went 6 months, but they couldn't get it through the Martian winter. So we got that to look forward to, this launch of this flying saucer shaped thing coming up, hopefully this week. It didn't go last week. It was supposed to go June 2nd, and they keep delaying it every day. Back to you, Dick.
I think it's called Mars. I mean, Space Odyssey. The name of the spacecraft that's about to fly by Pluto, and it's going to, I think it's going to fly by closest approach, something like July 14th, I believe. Is that this year or is that next year, Paul? I'm going to guess that it might be this year. And as it gets closer, I'd like to believe it's starting to take pictures, and we're starting to download those pictures. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yes, that's the New Horizon, launched almost 10 years ago, and you're like a month away. July 14th, you're correct, and that's this year. And that's what's fun about going onto this app. You know, the second you bring it up, or, you know, you're curious about it, you bring it up. You got the countdown right there, you know, 34 days, you know, 10 hours, so many seconds left. You know, that type of thing. And they'll get within 7,000 miles of the planet Pluto. And they're taking pictures now. They just did you know, they wanted to make sure everything was clear for the spacecraft, make sure there was no hidden moons that they didn't know about, debris or something around the orbit of Pluto. And they've done that. They ran a quite a few 10-second shots, you know, to keep the aperture open 10 seconds on each shot. I think they ran 100 different pictures. And they found nothing new, except that, you know, they're finding interesting things about their moons and how they orbit, what they're shaped like. Some of them aren't round. So you're roughly a month away from that. That's going to be all over the news. I guarantee that. Back to you, Dick.
The infrared telescope, I can't think of the name of it, administrator of Mars, of NASA is the name of it. At one time, that was going to be launched on 2016, but I think that was pushed off to 2018. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
That's James Webb Space Telescope. And, you know, they planned on 2018. I mean, at one time, it was originally called the New Generation Tennis Telescope, and that was when they thought about this 20 years ago. And they might have had earlier dates. You're probably thinking of that at that time. But by the time they actually came up with a plan and the instruments that were going to be on board and putting hardware together, they've been in this process probably, I don't know, it's got to be 10 years now, I guess. And this telescope will be launched from French Guiana in South America aboard an Ariane 5 spacecraft in 2018. A lot of things to look forward to. Next year you got Juno going into orbit. That's going into polar orbit around Jupiter. You've got European Space Agency is going to be launching a spacecraft to Mars. And then in 2018 as well, they're going to be launching a rover. There's a rover that's going to be going to Mars by the European Space Agency. EXO, what do they call it? EXO Mars rover. A lot of things coming up, Dick, but we're at a slow point now. This month, back to you, Dick.
Do we know the approximate weight of James Webb? Boy, that is a biggie. And it's going to go at that Lagrange point that's a million miles away from Earth, on the opposite side from the Sun. Boy, that's a lot of very precise hardware, a long distance away. And I'm not sure now, is that one powered by nuclear fuel or by solar panels? I'm going to get solar panels. And I'm going to guess that some of the orientation is by waving flags on the corner of the thing, a little bit similar to what is going on with, I can't think of the name of the telescope, but was measuring a number of stars out there that have planets.
The Kepler there.
Yeah, Kepler, I think they're now aiming Kepler with the flag approach, with the solar wind. I'm a little bit amazed that they didn't think of that one earlier. Now, is the James Webb's also going to be using the flag approach? And is the power for James Webb going to be solar panels or nuclear? And do we know the approximate weight of James Webb? It's got to be a biggie. Over to you, Paul. KQRIW.
It's gotten the weight of James Webb. I know it's as big as a tennis court. I remember that. And there's supposed to be one big panel on the bottom that's going to be adjustable. And as it gets hit by the solar wind, it will be adjustable. And Kepler's doing that now. Kepler, but it's kind of like a round, you know, telescope. It looks like a Hubble Space Telescope surrounded by only on three sides of the telescope solar panels. So the way they're arranging them, you know, it comes to the point to a point on these panels, and they're going to keep that point pointed toward the sun, and that will balance itself the way, you know, the way the solar wind, I guess, hits the panels. It's going to keep it. They're going to try to keep it centered like that. And in fact, that they're doing that now. And, of course, that thing is the sun. James Webb is going to be a different location. That's going to be a million miles out. And then the L2, Lagrange point 2. So, Lagrange point 1 is between the sun and the Earth. 2 is between, 2 is a million miles past the Earth in relationship to the sun. So it should be interesting. A lot of things have to work, Dick. Like you said, it's quite a contraption. And no way to fix this thing a million miles out. Unbelievable. They're going to put a ring on the bottom in case somebody in the future, if anybody, it would be one of these private companies like SpaceX, decides to go out and do something. They actually put a docking ring on the bottom of it. But I don't think that'll ever happen. I mean, they now have a docking ring on the bottom of Hubble. They did that on the last servicing mission. And, but the only purpose for that is going to be for spacecraft to eventually attach itself and then fire its rockets to deorbit it so they can have a controlled deorbit over the Pacific Ocean. I think that there's not going to be any more servicing to Hubble back either.
In the past, Paul, you've mentioned the possibility of doing remote piloted vehicle repairs, refueling, and whatever. That ring that you got on the bottom of Hubble could be a docking ring for that remotely piloted vehicle. There's been talk from time to time about using a remotely piloted vehicle to go to the geosynchronous satellites to refuel them. Because in many cases, the only thing that wears out is the consumables that does our station keeping. So I didn't say it's easy. And from time to time, I think we've heard talks about building vehicles. No human being is ever going to go to visit a geosynchronous satellite 22,300 miles out. There's a whole lot of reasons you don't want to be there. And it's very expensive to get there and to get back home again. So, have they given up on repairs? When I say they, I'm not only speaking of NASA, I'm speaking of all of the large number of other companies that are now in competition with NASA to launch vehicles. Have any of them had anything that they talked about to do with repairs in space? Back to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Latest one to talk about that, actually the only one really I read about that is thinking about it, is Lockheed. They're coming up with a system, the spacecraft is going to be called the Jupiter, which has nothing to do with Jupiter. And then it's going to be in conjunction with something called the Exoliner. Exoliner is another spacecraft. It's going to be kind of like a docking spacecraft, similar to Cygnus, bigger. Cygnus was the one that blew up, going up to the space station, mounted to the Antares rocket by Orbital Science. But, you know, something like that, a cargo type of vehicle. But they're going to put all the brains and the hardware and the rockets and fuel in a spacecraft called Jupiter. And they won't, their plan is to leave this in orbit, you know, permanently. So you'd have a launch of, let's say, an Atlas V, and Atlas V would bring up the Exoliner, put it into orbit. The Jupiter spacecraft would go over with a robotic arm to it and attach itself to, you know, it would dock to this Exoliner cargo craft. And then from there, it would fly over to the International Space Station, dock with it, unload the cargo, and then leave. Now, this thing's got a permanent docking arm to it. Now, their plan is long-term. This is Lockheed, by the way. So they would do this on a regular basis. Again, they would disconnect the Exoliner from the space station and bring it over and attach it to the upper stage that's still in orbit of the Atlas V. Attach it to that again, and then it would deorbit it and back into the Pacific Ocean. And they would do this over and over again. But in the future, they would like to use this system for going out to geosynchronous orbit, unmanned, of course, and then maybe bringing a fuel tank up, refueling, spacecraft in geosynchronous orbit or any other orbit, and eventually using it for cargo missions, going to the moon. People plan on going back to the moon. They have long-term plans, but they plan on doing this, you know, without NASA money. This is Lockheed money. But that's the latest I've heard on something like that. But otherwise, I mean, anything happening anytime soon? Probably not. Right, back to you, Dick.
A couple of weeks ago, we heard about the Progress ship that didn't successfully dock. Instability of one of those automatic thrusting systems on board, as I remember. And therefore, all of those consumables, all of that cargo that was being brought up, was lost. And therefore, the amount of spare materials you've got on board the International Space Station is not as much as it could have been. And I think you said that next week, some of the astronauts, cosmonauts on the International Space Station are going to come back down. Is there any possibility that their decision to come back down was motivated by the fact that the consumables are a little lower than they could be had that Progress made it? Did the failure of that Progress affect when we bring some of the astronauts back down? WS2N, KQLAW.
Well, they had at least 4 months supply on for six people on board the station. From what I read now, it's actually the opposite. They left this crew that's coming back now. They were supposed to come back a month ago. So, you know, they were supposed to go, I think, like 5.5 months, and now they're already 6.5 months up. They're going to have a total of 199 days. And the thought was, if they can't figure out what's wrong, now the Russians think they're going to handle on what the problem is. The thought was, well, maybe we're not going to be sending something back up, so they might come back. And apparently the problem is launching with this new upgraded Soyuz rocket system that they have. So apparently something wasn't right. Maybe they had the fuel Didn't shut off in time. It went a couple of seconds or something longer. And it, one thing affected another, and something didn't release right. So, doesn't sound like they have a positive answer yet, but they have a good idea. So they think they can correct it. And like I said before, earlier in the net, they did launch another identical Soyuz 2A, they call it, this upgraded version, but it didn't have a Soyuz Progress or a manned spacecraft on board, so it had a different docking or release contraption on it that put the space, the spacecraft, a regular satellite, into orbit, and that went fine. So we'll see. They have problems. The Proton rocket, they're still working on that problem. They launched the Proton rocket a couple of 2 weeks ago. That wound up coming back, crashing into Siberia. So the Russians have had their hands full. It's more of a reason why we need to make sure we have our own spacecraft to do what we got to do. Not only to put satellites in orbit, but to bring cargo to and from the station, people to and from the station. You know, you need independence, and I think that's more of a motivation to do just that, to try to get these other companies, these private companies more involved. There's a lot of them out there. You know, I mention on a regular basis, there's a whole slew of them that are involved with, you know, that you could have long-term contracts with. And the one, of course, on the top of the list is SpaceX and of course, Boeing with the CST 100 factory deck.
So there were six astronauts on the International Space Station right now, and I think three of them are going to come down on a Soyuz craft. Is that true, Paul? And that's going to take place in the next week or so?
Yeah, that'll be, what, Thursday the 11th this week. They're bringing back one of the Russians. He's the commander of the Soyuz spacecraft. Yeah, Burtz, he's the American astronaut. He'll be coming down with them. And also, you have Samantha, Christopher Eddy from the European Space Agency, and she'll be coming down. And that was her first flight up. Imagine going on her first flight up, and you spend 200 days in space. Pretty cool. Back to you, Dick.
Pretty cool, yes, but I think they've only got a partial solution to the bone loss mass that takes place in space. No matter how much you exercise, those bones are not being continuously flexed every hour of every day like they are in the Earth. And therefore the bones say, I don't need all this calcium. I can give up some of this, so your bones become a bit frail. And I think when you've been in space for that length of time and you come back down, you don't just walk out of that spacecraft. I think it takes quite a long time to re-acclimate for your vestibular, I think it's your balancing system in your ears, for it to start reorienting itself. I mean, it's had that fluid in those three canals in your ears are floating around freely for 200 days. And so the brain got used to that, and all of a sudden the fluid is going to be pooling down at the bottom. So you got to relearn that whole procedure of how to stay upright and how to walk. I think you literally have to learn how to re-walk when you've been in space that long. I found a beautiful website. Let me drop it. During the week, I don't know what I was looking for, but I suddenly ran into this thing where the cupola, I think they call it cupola, that thing that's got seven windows to it, where from those beautiful seven clear windows, you can take some extremely good space photography of Earth, space, whatever. But you probably know that there are seven sun shields, I'm going to call them sun shields, that can be placed over each of those seven windows to protect them from meteorites and whatever, to keep those, to keep the glass nice and clean and pock-free. And so each one of the seven windows has a shaft that goes through the wall with two O-rings, and it's a manually operated thing. And as you turn the knob inside the cupola, you are cranking a control that cranks the window shade, let's call it. It's a very sturdy looking thing with an O-ring around the perimeter, which clamps itself down on the outside of each one of those windows, one at a time.